Hello and welcome. You're listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. Hello and welcome to episode 61 of Writers Aloud. In this episode, the novelist Jill Dawson tells Frances Burns about her writing's physicality and the surprising richness of the Fens.
Reading Jill Dawson's novels is like entering a physical landscape. Places and bodies are atmospheric, emotional. Her characters tangle with sexuality and love, succumbing to both. Jill uses gesture vividly. In her latest novel, The Telltale Heart, a mother listens to her dead son's heart beating in another man's chest, the chest of a man whose life's just been saved by the heart's transplant. Most essentially, Jill gives her characters voices. In The Telltale Heart, the voices of the transplant patient and a Fenland ancestor of the boy whose heart he now has both speak to us, in their own present, from their own point of view. Some of the characters Jill embodies are real people. For example, the poet Rupert Brooke stars in her The Great Lover, and she dares imagine his inner voice as he visits nearby Grantchester, seducer and seduced.
Jill, is the process of writing a very physical experience for you?
Yes, it is, I'm sure, although I don't think I've realised it. To me, it's quite an intuitive process. I tend not to plan. I just begin. But the things I do in my life, I mean, swimming and writing is a big part of my life. So I swim to work things out. And I'm sure that has an impact on the writing because it makes a certain rhythm. And because writer's life is very sedentary, I do a lot of yoga. So also when I'm, you know, in between writing, I might be stretching and thinking.
What do you feel like when you're writing?
I need to be in a certain mood to write well. I'm very kind to myself, so if I'm not in the mood, I don't do it. I'll go off for a walk, or I'll go swimming, or I'll go somewhere else. I don't sit at my desk. I don't write every day. I've never believed in that rule. It doesn't work for me. It never has. I had a baby quite young in my sort of writing life, so I was 26. And so therefore I've always had to fit in around having children. I had another one at 39 and foster child at 50. So I've always had to fit my life around the sort of domestic scene. And that means that I don't give myself a hard time if the day's not successful. I come back to writing when I'm back in the mood. I like to have nice smells around me. So quite often I'll have hyacinths on my desk or candles. So I make the environment very pleasing. It's not a place of punishment. I don't think of it as going to work like a trial. I think of it as a place of pleasure and dreaming, and that's how I like best to write.
Has that developed for you, or did you find that early on?
I think I understood quite early, and it's been a big part of my teaching, that I'm a carrot, not a stick kind of person, that things work better for me if there's an incentive. If my study is a lovely place to go to, I'm more likely to want to go there. And if I make it austere and associated with duty, work, all those negative things for me, I have to say, I've never had a job and I've never wanted one, then it wouldn't work for me. And if I was going to have the freedoms of being a writer, but the difficulties of being freelance, of not having a regular income, then I wouldn't make that a sort of horrible experience for myself. I might as well choose it and actively enjoy it. And actually, I do sometimes feel irritated with this kind of myth of, you know, the struggling, miserable writer which gets presented to us as if that is the only possibility. It might be, as it is for me, a feeling of absolute luxury, almost audaciousness. How dare I do this thing I've always loved to do since childhood and do it for my living? That's how I feel about it.
Let's describe what you can see and where we are, because I want to talk about place and how you imbibe it.
Yes, so this is my study where I work, and I do have three big windows at the top, three different views, one of them all the way to Ely Cathedral, one of them over the top of the sort of fens, and then one of them out to the street, whereas when my children were younger, I could watch them playing on their bikes and kind of keep an eye on who's coming and going. The fen soil is the blackest in the world. It's one of the richest. It's called the black oil. This is the breadbasket of Europe, and it's because it's centuries of peat, a lot of which was underwater. So the fens is recently drained. I think that's something people often don't realise. And to me, that gives it a spooky feeling. And when I'm stuck, I will go out for a walk. And the walking means, I mean, I'll give you a perfect and very simple example. The barn owl, who features such a lot in The Telltale Heart, is on the cover, was simply because when I went for a walk, there always seemed to be a barn owl there. And it would fly out with that very low flight they have. Very quiet and ghostly, very beautiful, with a heart-shaped face. And I thought it wants to be in the novel. So the idea of how place and environment come into my work is as straightforward as that. I go out into it, it comes back in. And I really need that. I often need to go places, which is another great indulgence.
Because I was going to ask you, do you think you could write a novel that was set on the moon?
Well, it's interesting. I'm always, again, when I'm teaching, I say to my students, it's an act of imagination. Of course you can set it anywhere. And I can cite wonderful novels where people have set them places they don't know. But that's not the same as saying what we need to do, is it? And for me, for example, in The Great Lover, Rupert Brooke ends up in Tahiti, in the South Seas. It's a very long trip, and I've been there twice. And I feel I got a great deal from that. I mean, of course, it's a lovely, glamorous place to go, so I might well argue that. But it was the idea, actually, of, given the journey feels so far still, it took me 24 hours last time, for Rupert Brooke, who would have been travelling, you know, in a boat all around the world to get there, he must have felt he was on the moon. And so that sense of how foreign the experience was and how freeing for him, how he could be someone else in that environment, that came to me when I was in Tahiti. And those are the sorts of things I feel are valuable for a novelist.
Is it that you need to know what a place feels like and how it comes in at all the senses, not just at the mind?
Exactly that. I mean, when my students talk about research, they'll often say, I looked this up on Google or I read it. And that's such a flat experience. That's not, I'm talking about taste. I'm talking about, what does Tahiti smell like? What about this flower that changes colour between morning and night? What's it like to swim in the lagoons with these exquisitely lovely fish, which would have been there 100 years ago? So there's a direct connection with the past that you can make. There's no substitute for this physical experience of going somewhere and feeling it. And in fact, even think places I do know. So The Great Lover, which is the novel we're talking about, it's set just before the First World War, featuring Rupert Brooke and the voice of Rupert Brooke, but also featuring the voice, the completely fictional voice, of a young fen woman from around here where I live. And it's a love story, I suppose, and it's set also mainly Grantchester and Prickwillow. And in Grantchester, I did walk the routes that Brooke would have walked across the meadows. And in walking them, I was able to think of things like, well, that would have been there then, that tree perhaps, but not that building. And there's a sort of sense of really concentrating hard in conjuring up his physical experience of a place, which is what I love to do.
Place also gives us voices, not just dialect, the whole physicality of a voice. And to me, your human voices are akin to bird song in that way, that it's like people are singing their territory.
Oh, how lovely. I love that idea, bird song and territory. I think you're absolutely right that I can only get the voice when I've got the location. And that's what I'm often seeking. I spend a lot of time with voice. I'll write the novel first sometimes to thrash it out, to get the story vaguely down, and then go back to the voice. And say for Willie Bemis.
So he's the ancestor of the original owner of the Telltale Heart.
Yes, this fen ancestor 200 years ago. I mean, I did listen to some BBC recordings of, it's a very difficult accent, the Suffolk and Cambridgeshire and Fenlander accent. So it wasn't quite that I wanted. In the end, I returned to the poetry of John Clare, who's from not that far away, closer to Peterborough, but still, and was reading his work, I mean, it's in many different forms because people do change the dialect, and there's been a big debate about whether to do that with John Clare's poetry. So I also had to look at many versions to see how he expressed himself. And then I suddenly found I could hear the voice I wanted in my head, and that's the point at which then I go back to the writing. So it's a fusion. It's not strictly a particular voice, but I need something to go off. I'm doing something very odd at the moment, but I'm not going to talk about that. It's too soon. I always think my novels are odd when I'm working on them.
Do you?
I do, yes. I do wonder at what I've taken on. I mean, The Telltale Heart, trying to explain to people, I'm suggesting that someone has had a heart transplant and is now beginning to tune in to the voices of the ancestors of his heart. I mean, it does sound crazy. But I think that's exactly why I go into it. I think the challenge has to be there. I have to feel, and I always do, this is actually beyond me. Can I really do this? I mean, I had said to my editor with The Telltale Heart that the heart would narrate some of the novel. And I don't think it does exactly or literally, but there was for me a feeling of rhythm, a heartbeat that I often heard as I was writing the John Clare sort of Willie Beanis, more poetic sections. And I feel in those, sometimes the heart did step forward as the narrator to a degree, and that was something I wanted. I couldn't sustain it throughout, but I definitely sometimes heard it that way.
It's funny, when you were talking about the voice, it's not quite, although we're talking about writing in the first person, and we're also talking about people narrating, there's something more than that in your voices.
But it might be the body that you've identified. Partly because I did start my writing life as a poet, and I wrote poetry for the first sort of 5 to 8 years and published poetry and didn't want to be a novelist. I don't write poetry at all anymore. But the thing that I feel was happening for me there was the development of the ear. You know, it was all about how language sounded, the kind of cadence and rhythms. And I feel that's often what is going on in my work. I don't mind if readers don't notice. But for me, it's really important often how I hear something, and I'll read sections out loud to myself. Well, also perhaps the simple fact that I listen to music when I'm writing, which I know many writers would find a really strange, you know, very difficult. They couldn't be thinking with the music going on. But what it is with me is I often choose a piece of music or a particular song and play it over and over and over so that I'm no longer really listening consciously, but it's there underneath. And for The Great Lover, the Rupert Brooke novel, I had a piece of music. Oh, I'm going to forget his name now. Not Neil Young. It'll come back to me. But anyway, by an old folk singer who had died and who had died young and been very gifted, but his life was finished about the same age as Rupert Brooke's, 27. And somehow that song would evoke Rupert Brooke for me, and that's what I was often listening to. Fruit Tree. It's called Fame is But a Fruit Tree. Each novel, I will do that. I will have the music. And it might be the music of the era. For Lucky Bunny, which is all set in the criminal world of sort of the 40s, 50s, 60s in London, the song that many criminals choose for their sort of funeral is My Way. Frank Sinatra. They love it. And so I would listen to that an awful lot. And this very bombastic attitude, I did it my way, I took the blows, is a big feature of the voice in Lucky Bunny. Because she's also suggesting that maybe she didn't survive quite as well as you might think, that she was very hurt. But she's still a tremendous optimist who wants to say, well, so what if it wasn't legal or conventional? And that tension between those two positions is contained in that song.
I think that's great. I think that's about your voices aren't storytelling in an abstract way. They're answering back.
Answering back. Well, who even knows? I mean, I'm a great believer in the idea that what goes into a novel is only partially conscious on the author's part and also on the reader's. So my favourite quote about what constitutes a good novel, Henry James and Toybin, I think, said a version of this. It contains a secret and tells a secret at the same time. So it keeps a secret and tells a secret. And that tension, so I feel that I pour everything into my work and I hope that people receive something out of it. But some of it must remain, you know, rather secret and mysterious and under the surface. And that's where the body probably plays its part. And the idea that there are rhythms, musicality, things that we can feel, but not necessarily intellectualise. So we might know them with the body, not necessarily with the mind. The concept of knowing with the body is an explicit theme in one of my novels, only one of them, I think, which is Watch Me Disappear, which is a novel where a woman, Tina, comes back to the Fens, having gone away to America, become a very eminent scientist. But there's something she feels she knows deep down, but has never admitted she knows. And she has epileptic seizures, so there's a part of her that just blanks things out. But still, she knows it at a very deep level with her body. The whole novel is my attempt to show the ways in which she might come to terms with that knowledge. It's the absolute opposite of a whodunit, because she can never prove it. My sort of interest in that novel is, does she learn to live with what she knows is true, with every fibre of her being? And yet she can't really prove because, well, I won't spoil the whole novel, but, you know, because some of the characters involved are dead, and, you know, the one she thinks is the murderer is dead. So she can't prove it. But it's about being sort of true to what you know with your body. And I think that's a very interesting idea. Oh, certainly interests me enough to write a whole novel on it and obsess over it for a while. And I find that a fascinating part of sort of digging over our own histories. And possibly that's the way I'm approaching it, really, what feels to be true.
Also, it's that, like her body, that character.
Tina.
Tina's body gives her away. Tina's body stores her story.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. You notice that.
So the idea that from little girlhood I learnt to do yoga, and so I've done my yoga more or less every day of my life. I don't feel normal if I don't do a few stretches. Means that I suppose I am noticing and aware of those things in ways that others might not be. But interestingly, when I teach creative writing, I've often observed people's body language when they ask me a question about their work. So students might say things like, I've got two projects and I could write this one, but I'm quite drawn to that one. And they expect me to sort of, you know, arbitrate. But quite often, I'll just look at them and think, well, everything in your body suggests it should be that one because you're so excited and involved and passionate. And that other one is the one you think you should be doing, or someone's told you would sell or make money or something. So I'm, without really sort of necessarily acknowledging it, I'm sort of tuning in to their body language. And I feel that, again, perhaps being a mum quite young, I don't really know what it is, but it's sort of, you know, I've had to notice, I suppose, very much people's physical selves, not just what they say or tell you, but very much what they tell you otherwise with the rest of themselves. And that interests me immensely.
I was going to come back to teaching later, but my question for you about teaching was what is it that you're teaching when you notice that your body is alive and fired up?
One of the things I do notice, for example, in my students is I'll ask them where they think their unwritten, unproduced work is at the moment. Is it in their computer? Is it in their head? Is it out there in the world? And I'll watch where people gesticulate. And I'm very interested in this idea of where is something we haven't yet made? Where is it? Because for me, it's inside me. And I often notice my gestures suggest that, as if it's something I have to pull out. But I think it's also very interesting that people experience these novels as over there. And it's like, well, pull it closer if you're going to write it and make it yours. You know, people tap their heads, or they think it's in their brain, or they tap their laptop. It's very interesting where something that we haven't yet made, but want to make, and imagine ourselves making, where does it exist?
I don't know if this is too big a question, but how do you make how do you make your character who's speaking in their voice moving?
Well, that one is such a difficult... It's a difficult thing to talk about because I find them moving quite often I can reduce myself to tears. You know, Willie Bemis is about to be hanged and then is reprieved at the very last minute. It's a very, to me, upsetting moment, and his father is hanged, and I did cry when I wrote that scene. So I suppose my theory has always been that if I'm moved, maybe a reader will be. The same with Edith Thompson at the end of Fred Needy. She has to go to her death, and I know that throughout because I've researched the novel, and it's not giving anything away to say she's hanged. It says it on the back of the novel. But she doesn't know that. She always believes she'll be let off the hook at the last minute. So I keep writing it as if she's hoping that the British public will see that she wasn't guilty and she will be reprieved. So at the moment where she finally realises that isn't going to happen, I think I put all my efforts into that imaginative moment that a novel needs to have, I think, a kind of climactic emotional moment. I think my work generally does. And I'm quite interested in notions of things like rapture. So it might not always be a terrible moment like the one I've just described. It might be actually a fantastic one where a character says to themselves, I'm alive in this world. How amazing is that? And those are the ones I work hard for, to try to kind of just... And I always feel it's beyond me, actually. It's incredibly frustrating, because language doesn't do the trick at that point, I feel. But I still go after it, just the same.
This is slightly odd, just the thing I noticed. That a number of the characters we've talked about, like Edith Thompson and Rupert Brooke, were real people. And they're famous in one sense for the way in which they died. And is that interesting to you?
How I'd interpret that question is, I mean, I love biography. So that idea of, well, how is a life perceived once it is over, interests me immensely. How do those living it, who don't know how it's going to end, how do they think of their own lives? So there's a little tension there, because I know with Edith Thompson or whatever that, you know, that's the ending for her. And as I said, she doesn't know throughout. But I also feel that, say, something that's in The Telltale Heart, explicitly in there, because I remember it from school, is the Thomas Hardy moment in Tessa d'Urberville's, where he talks about the date of our death, all of us, each and every one of us, not being known. We celebrate the date of our birth, and we all know when our birthday is. But we don't know what is the date that we're going to die on. It's such an odd idea, and I think I was 16 when I read Tessa d'Urberville's. It really lodged in my brain as a very strange concept. And I think that I also read a fabulous writer and psychotherapist called Irvin Yalom, who I've read many, many times, love his work, and I write to him periodically and he replies to my amazement. And he has written a lot about death anxiety, the idea that we all know we're mortal, but we can't necessarily know anything more than that, when we will die, how we will die. And I've sort of embraced that somehow as such a compelling and interesting concept. So for some of my characters, I, the writer, do know, but they never know. And then there's the moment in The Telltale Heart where the young boy, who's been dead from the beginning of the novel, if you like, because it's his heart that's threading through it, where he faces, ah, is this it for me? And to me, it's a very interesting moment of existence and acknowledgement of the fleeting existence of each life. So I think that's quite a thread in my work.
Like, another aspect of your characters is the fact that part of their crisis is in their sexuality. Do you consciously look for characters whose sexuality is part of their story?
I really don't consciously look for them. I absolutely accept it's there, because interestingly, the novel I'm writing about is, you know, a writer who is a sort of as open a lesbian as it was possible to be in the 1950s and 60s. So in that respect, yet again, I've chosen someone with a very interesting sexuality and certainly some conflicts around it. I suppose it's part again of kind of the fact that the characters have bodies, and that their bodies determine very often the way the narrative goes. So if, for example, we go back to Edith Thompson, if she hadn't made that first decision as a slightly older woman to sleep with this young tenant of hers, with very great risk in 1919 for a married woman to do such a thing. So her body, if you like, led her into trouble. And with Rupert Brooke, I think the desire that he kept expressing in his letters, which was the thing I was mostly reading and the thing I kept picking up on, was nothing as straightforward as was he gay, straight, bi, or any of those contemporary labels, but just how could he meld together his love and his physical desire and his sense of himself into one happier form? And that seemed to be about the fact that almost he was expected not to have a body, you know, to live in his intellect. And I think that is quite a common problem for sometimes over-educated people, let's say. So for those two novels, I see that theme. With Watch Me Disappear, it's a very explicit theme. It's a young woman who's suddenly reassessing her early sexual relationships and the ways in which perhaps a certain promiscuity had been about seeking something or expressing something that she didn't know was being expressed that way. So it goes back to the idea, I suppose, that again, the body might know more. And her body was certainly telling her, I think, that some things in her life were rather, you know, over-sexualized, inappropriately sexualized, that there was difficulty around this area. So yes, in my novels, I can see that as a theme. I guess it's part of my exploration of character, which interests me so much more than plot. So sex isn't used as a plot device in my novel at all, really. It doesn't particularly move the narrative along. So I suppose in that sense, my novels are character-driven, and that I'm much more interested in the forces of the unconscious, which are sort of dictating our lives, it seems to me.
Can we bring them back to landscape? Whether landscape has a sort of sexuality?
The physicality of landscape. I mean, the moment in my work where I think that theme might have come together most explicitly in my head is, and I hope that... Well, it did seem to me I didn't begin with this. I was going to say, I don't like the idea you start with something, but that you find it halfway through. Is I think there is a moment in The Telltale Heart when I describe the Fens exactly like a heart, with arteries and sort of muscles. And it's simply because having walked in it every day as I was writing, and then the heart was what I was thinking about, and then looking at images of the heart, and looking at heart transplant operations on screen. I never went to see one, thank goodness, because I'm much too squeamish. But finally, the two things fuse together in my imagination. And I feel that sort of sense of what landscape might be, does it get under our skin, literally? I mean, as a girl, I worked briefly cabbage picking. It was in Yorkshire. I was 14. And I wrote a poem called The Only Girl in Her Field when I was 14. And it amused me because the idea of being the only girl in that field, literally, but in science, it's usually said. And I think those ideas came into a novel, Watch Me Disappear, that I wrote when I was 40. Those are little thoughts about field, place, feminism, sexuality, because in fact, one of the things I noticed, or gender on that occasion, was that because I was cabbage picking with a load of boys, A, they were quicker than me and got more money, but B, they just peed anywhere they wanted. Where the girls, me and my other friend who joined me finally, would have to walk quite far to get away from them, which slowed down our picking so that we didn't get as much money. So that sort of sense, that's the only time I've ever worked on the land. But I mean, I'm looking at it now and the soil is fantastic. And I think it does, if you allow it to, sort of get under your skin and enter your work. You're not seeing it today necessarily. It is a bit foggy, actually. It's often foggy. And the soil is tremendously rich. And it is kind of oily. It's gorgeous. Black gold, it's been called. I do love it, yes.
That was Jill Dawson in conversation with Frances Burns. You can find out more about Jill on the RLF website. And that concludes episode 61, which was recorded and produced by Frances Burns. Coming up in episode 62, the children's writer and poet Kathy Henderson shares her joy in being a global lullaby collector, and the children's writer Harriet Caster wonders why writers always get asked the same question. We hope you'll join us. You've been listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. To subscribe to podcasts and to find out more about the work of the RLF, please visit our website at www.rlf.org.uk. Thanks for listening.